things started now. We have two more chunks to talk through about social justice in the light, through the lens of the immigration debate. The care of creation and the concept of solidarity. So we're going to try to do those today and see where we are. All right? Care for creation is the church term for environmentalism. In the secular world, we call that, you know, they call it environmentalism, thinking about the earth and the world around us. In the church, we call it care for creation because it feels more connected to the command of God in Genesis for us to care for the earth and for God's creation. So that's why we use that term. So as we talk about building an ethic of justice, that's one of the things we have to care about. Now, with immigration, if that is our issue that we're looking at through the lens of justice, it's a little more tangential, right? How do we think about the environmental impact of immigration? And you can talk about the impact of the environment on immigration. You can also talk about the impact of immigration on the environment. Right? So in our current time, one of the things that's driving some of the current immigration is climate change. And that's only going to get worse. Right?
Meaning there are warmer areas where people are...
Well, there are places that used to be livable that now either are covered in water or are...
Getting drier,
and it's really happening in Africa. Places that used to be arable, where you could grow food, now you can't. It's also happening in Indonesia. Islands that you used to be able to live on, within 5 years will be underwater as the sea levels rise. But you also see it, I mean, our crazy weather is driven by that. Stronger storms, more frequent storms.
Bigger fires,
those kinds of things. All of that drives migration, right? People move away from places that they can't live anymore. Well, where do they go? They go to places where... but also it causes economic disruption, right? If your economy is based on being able to grow food in this particular area, and you can't grow food in that particular area anymore, you have to reset your economy, and that takes time. We have the experience of this in the United States. You all remember studying the Dust Bowl in your, that the drought in the Midwest drove people out of the Midwest to California, right? Largely because they were already west. And you all might have read books about that. You know, John Steinbeck wrote one. So how do we do, but then also, when we talk about immigration and care of creation, moving populations have an impact on the environment. So for example, moving someone who lived in a third world country to a first world country changes the environmental footprint of that person. So if you had lived in a place where you had minimal impact on your environment, and you move to the United States where you have a car and travel on roads and use air conditioning and
plastic bottles,
and the more people that, or, you know, if we have you stay where you are and help develop your economy there. All right, so you get the concept of the ideas. So what does justice look like? What would an ethic of justice look like for immigration, taking into account the care of creation?
And I don't know if it includes, picking crops that Americans won't pick, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually... helping our environment to stay productive and provide food for us.
Mm-hmm. Or
I don't know if that...
it might, or you could flip it and look at it the other way.
Yeah.
That say that if we didn't have labor to pick the, if we didn't use immigrant labor to pick the crops, maybe we wouldn't plant crops. So then would we not farm that land, which in the first place, or would we import food from further away, which would, what would we do with that land if we didn't have the labor to pick the crops?
So it seems even more basic that if you worried about the environment, if you paid attention to the science in the first place, not that they had done things 25, 50 years ago, then people wouldn't be moving around. I mean, I understand Louisiana, there's fishermen down there whose land is being, they are very aware that they're tributaries, that they can't fish anymore. You know, if those things aren't being taken care of in the first place, you are going to have those people moving.
Why can they not fish them anymore? But
they're not being inhabited. Either they're getting too warm, or the land is going underwater.
Right. Or there's pollution.
I don't know if pollution is so much a problem as the land is going underwater.
But pollution is certainly happening in Lake Erie. The reason we keep having algae blooms is because the fertilizer is washing off into the lake, and that fertilizes not only the crops on the land that it's growing, but the algae in the lake. And
I thought about that, this, not to bring up tangential things, but Westwood Country Club, they're having trouble developing it because it was a golf course, and the runoff and... Because the golf courses we have in this area that are being treated with, oh my God.
With chemicals.
Chemicals. And I know that Park Country Club is, the creek runs right through it. So it's got to be going, that's another, but that's an issue, yeah.
Now,
caring more about weeds, I guess.
If we're not being good stewards of our world, this creation, that's a sin. So we need to be more careful about, like you said, throwing away bottles, using too much plastic, all that kind of stuff. So if you're, and sometimes you do things and you're not aware that you're harming the environment. So if you do something without knowledge of the repercussions of that, like on the environment, is that a sin?
Well, it depends. When we confess sins, we talk about things known and unknown, sins that we know about and sins that we don't know about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yes and no. certainly doing something, the basic definition of sin is putting yourself or something else in the place that belongs to God.
Your will instead of his will.
And his will. So, for example, if you put your convenience ahead of the commandment of God to care for his creation, that's a sin. Whether you're consciously aware of it when you're doing it or not doesn't really impact... whether or not you're putting something in the place that belongs to God in your life. So that's, when we say all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, when we quote that from scriptures, that's what we mean. When we say everybody's a sinner, that's what we mean, is that so much of our lives, we just unconsciously put ourselves or something else in the place that really should belong to God. And we do it, it's not that we get up in the morning and say, I'm going to go sin today. It's that we get up in the morning and live our lives, and in the course of living our lives, we fail to, it's going to be Ash Wednesday next week, and the litany of penitence is really clear. You know, we have not given thought to those who come after us. We have not, we have failed to honor God in each person we meet. Not that we get up in the morning and think, I'm going to go out and fail to honor God in each person I meet today, but it's snowing out and I just want to get home for the love of heaven, So I'm going to fail to...
humanness.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be a human being. That's what we mean. That's why in the baptismal covenant, we renounce the sinful forces of this world which corrupt and destroy the creatures of God, that's what we're talking about, right?
Isn't the real sin when it comes to the environment, though? I mean, there is, to me, there's only one reason people are denying the science, because it put regulations on corporations and their inability to make money. That can, to me, that's the only reason that people could be ignoring a science that is right before them on a big level. So it's filtering down, and people are saying, "Oh, okay, then it's not real." Because nobody seems to be paying attention. To me, that's the real sin of it all.
Also, when you're talking about sin, you're talking about people who are people of faith primarily, many of whom or most of whom go are going to church, but there are a lot of truly good people out there for whom, sin,
Well, they might call it something else.
Right.
It's almost like when you were describing, it's almost like you're unconscious of what what you're doing. It. So they might call it something else besides sinning, but they might know that what they're doing is not good. It's not. And like you said, they're putting money first.
Putting money first.
Money is the value rather than conservation.
That's like putting another God before me.
Yes, yes. Exactly.
There really are two major things that get put in the place of God. Money is certainly one. Comfort/convenience is the other, right? I mean, if we truly wanted to do something about climate change, we could look as Americans at how we live. But that would mean probably not each of us driving our own cars, which would really change the way we live our lives, right? We would look at how we build and heat our homes. We would look at the size of homes that we have. Yeah. I live in a 4-bedroom house with my cat. I use quite a lot of energy to heat.
Yeah, that's true.
A 3-story, 4-bedroom house for me. Not that I'm willing to give that up, you understand. and I admit that. That is an unrepented sin of mine. But it is, putting my comfort in the place that, God says, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, as long as it doesn't make me uncomfortable, Lord.
Being more aware of what other countries do is one thing we could do. We had a German foreign exchange student for a while, and one thing I had to do was make her lunch every day. So every day she brought home the plastic bag I put her sandwich in, and brought home her brown paper bag. And when she was getting ready to leave, we lived in a big university town. We wanted to buy her a T-shirt, as a souvenir. She's like, "I don't need any T-shirts. I have plenty of T-shirts." I mean, just with that very small contact with her, you could see, what they do in Germany compared to what we do. And Germany is similar. I mean, they're a prosperous country with a lot of modern stuff, but it was so different.
It probably was just her, though, not necessarily that it was a...
Well, she said, in Germany they don't... Nobody wastes plastic like that. Everything is recycled and used as much as possible. So she did, I don't know about the T-shirt part, but the rest of it, is definitely from her country.
Well, I think industry and the corporations have cultivated our country to be a throwaway country because they want to sell more products. And I think that's part.
Well, and to bring it back to the immigration issue, part of the reason we can live in a throwaway society is that we now bring a lot of things in from places where they make them cheaply. And the reason they're able to make them cheaply is they don't pay people very much because those people don't live like we live, right? So part of, when I was growing up, clothes were... more expensive compared to the income, right, than they are now. And so, you mended things more and you had fewer things. Beginning in about 1980, they started making clothes overseas. Compared to income, the price of clothing is incredibly cheap. We don't mend things anymore because it's not worth it, you know.
I do too. You know,
we're sewers, so, though.
Yeah. Well, but, and we used to make our... My mother used to... I remember the first time my mother bought me a dress in the store. Mm-hmm. She made everything until I was like 10 years old. Mm-hmm.
I had an aunt that made all my clothes when I was a child also.
Yeah.
But it was more we took care of them. We had a Sunday dress and we wouldn't throw it in the wash. But we took care of it, took it off as soon as we came home. And that's true. It was probably when the China markets opened up.
Well, and also the cost of sewing has gone up so much. Mm-hmm. It used to be cheaper. Now it's more expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say, it used to be much cheaper to make your own clothes because the fabric was relatively inexpensive, but the labor that went into the clothing was expensive, so the made clothing was expensive. Now that's flipped.
Yeah.
But how do you now? Because we talked so much about the philosophy, the great line, and I listened because I was here last time to your discussion. I found it interesting the way you talked about people who've made it now look back on the people coming up, and I mean that obviously has something to do with immigration. But what's the what's the philosophy behind people? Some are for immigration, think it's okay, some not. That's what I find so interesting, even not right now with this battle with the wall. Mm-hmm. Why some? Is that, I mean, like...
There are lots of reasons that people take different political positions, but they're kind of throughout history. We have a fear of the other. And part of, at least part of, what is going on in our current immigration discussion is either explicit or implicit bias. The people who are immigrating now don't look like us, right? Now, people say they don't speak our language. Well, none of the immigrants that have come over have spoken our language. That's never been true. But the group that's coming now doesn't look like us. And so that makes it easy to say, well, they're the other, right? So that's one piece.
I'm just wondering, though, I mean, we're quick to assign a mean.
Right.
Can you assign something that's not...
Some of the other reasons that go into being anti-immigration, jobs worried about, but again, that's
actually a false... Yeah, that's actually a false reason.
But a lot of people are concerned about jobs.
People are concerned about that, that also comes out of a fear of scarcity. Mm-hmm. That there's only so much to go around, and if somebody else comes, I won't have. That's actually economically not true. What will harm our economy is not having enough labor. Not having too much labor.
Because not all the immigrants, that are coming up the, whatever that was called in Mexico, they're not all migrant workers. I mean, there are a lot of highly educated people on these groups, you know, that are fleeing the oppression. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Well, and you said a positive thing is the United Nations mandate to help or to open...
To open your borders to refugees,
the
United Nations refugees, but thinking about a kind of morally neutral reason to be opposed to immigration is difficult to come up with, particularly from a Christian perspective, where God's commandments to us are pretty universal to welcome the stranger.
Care for the poor.
You know, welcome the stranger. You know, it's hard to read scripture and find a commandment of God to keep the other out. And the places where you can find it are very context specific. It's when Israel is first moving into the land and becoming a nation. Mm-hmm. And God commands them to keep the foreigners at a distance, to keep the people of Israel pure. There are a few of those you can find throughout scripture that are specific to that particular time, but the general flow of scripture is to welcome the stranger, to care for the poor, to treat the foreigner as you would treat yourself.
Especially in the New Testament.
Yeah, in the New Testament, but also in the Old Testament law. The the Levitical law and the law of Deuteronomy have rules about treating the foreigner as you would treat yourself. As a matter of fact, in the Ten Commandments, the longer explanation of the Ten Commandments says that the command for Sabbath, for no one to work on Sabbath, also applies to foreigners in your land. That not only are you not supposed to work on Sabbath, you're not supposed to make your foreign servant work on the Sabbath.
I think in other religions too. I mean, in Islam, mm-hmm. people give a certain percentage to the poor. Mm-hmm. That's one of the
five pillars.
Five pillars of Islam.
Yes, and you've helped me move into my next thing talk about. Our next group that I'll talk about grouping later. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, it's hard to find a morally neutral reason to be against immigration, which is part of the reason that when we talk about social justice, it's hard to build an ethic of justice around keeping people out. Right?
Another motivation is what? Gigi, I think her name?
Yes.
She doesn't want to become, and none of us do, want to become a minority, you know, in our country.
Faith-wise or?
No, ethnically.
So that again comes back to, you know, fear of the other.
Yeah.
We don't want the others to come in because we don't want to become the other. And that also comes out of a place of fear. Mm-hmm. Really, if you look at human behavior, there are a limited number of things that drive our behavior. And the negative ones tend to come down to greed, fear. Really, greed and fear are if you boil down,
and a desire for control.
Yes, that's a good one.
Power.
Greed, fear, and power.
Mm-hmm.
The negative ones: love, generosity, and caring drive our positive behaviors. And to be a human being is to live in the tug of war between those forces. Right? That's human nature. None of us live in love all the time. None of us live in greed or the lust for power or fear all the time. We live in the tension.
And then you notice, too, that and at least in our country, and we're keeping it local, that fear of the unknown seems to be coming from people who are the most isolated, who don't have contact with, you know, in the big cities where, you're all together, people aren't as fearful, so ignorance.
Right, is exactly. True. Contact with another language, with another culture, with another world is so helpful, but most Americans lack that.
And that's
such a big country that we can
isolate ourselves. And that actually, we're moving on to the last point, which is solidarity, the idea that we all are one. Is the last point in building ethics. Is if we're going to make an ethical decision, how does this build the sense that we all are one, we all belong here? In the Episcopal Church, we tend to talk about this, about the incarnational reality. It has been true in every kind of movement towards justice in life, that moving people towards justice is easier when you're talking about knowing an individual who belongs to the group. And I'll use myself as an example. When I was ordained to the priesthood 20 years ago, it still was relatively early in women clergy in the Episcopal Church. We ordained women to the priesthood the first time in 1976. So when I was ordained in 1997, it had been 20 years, but it was still, it was still newer. And so there were a lot of people who hadn't really encountered women clergy, maybe, or who still weren't sure what they thought about it. And every woman priest will tell you that they have had this encounter of someone coming up to them and going, "Well, I don't really like the idea of women priests, but I like you." And Sarah's raising her hand in there.
Sarah.
and you learn pretty early. going on to go, well, isn't that nice? Thank you so much. Because you can't say, do you have any idea how incredibly offensive that is? Thank you very much. You know, that moves on. And the same thing happens is when it happened most recently in our church with the issue of gay marriage. When New York passed marriage equality, the bishop asked each vestry to have a conversation about whether or not that church would offer gay marriage. And our vestry said, well, we don't want to put a sign out that says, you know, hey, we do gay marriages. I said, well, our marriage policy says that any member can, you know, request to be married here. Is that okay? And, you know, they named by name the homosexual couples who were members of the parish. Well, of course they can get married here. I said, well, our marriage policy also says the children of members can get married here. So is that okay? Well, of course, you know, so-and-so's daughter and so-and-so's son can get married here.
So people they know.
Right. And I said, well, it says the grandchildren of members can get married here. Like, well, yeah, of course. You know, that's, you know, we know who those are.
Right.
And I said, well, and then the last thing in our marriage policy says that others at the discretion of the rector. And I said, well, of course, if there's somebody you think should be, I'm like, okay. So basically what we're saying is our marriage policy applies.
So when you say your vestry, it's just your church?
Just our church.
You each decide.
Because the bishop said, you know, the state of New York has made this legal. We have a right approved in the Episcopal Church that we can use for this, as long as it's legal in this jurisdiction. So he asked each vestry to have the conversation. And our vestry said, well, okay, you know, it looks like our policy is our policy. Mm-hmm. But if I had said to the vestry, are we in favor of gay marriage? I don't know. It wouldn't have been the same conversation. But when it was tied to individuals they knew, well, then you can't, it's harder to say, well, you know. And so that's what I mean by solidarity or incarnational theology, that if I see you as an individual, as a person, and I know you, then it's harder for me to be unjust to your face. It's still possible for people, but it's harder. And so that's the same thing we were talking about. The more contact you have with
others,
and the more that you can talk about people as people instead of as groups, right? And that's, so the more that we can shift the conversation to, well, let's talk about human beings. It's part of the reason that, to bring it back to immigration, that social justice advocates try to get people to talk about undocumented people as opposed to illegal immigrants. Just the change in the wording,
right?
From, well, that's someone who's an illegal.
Especially the word alien.
Alien. Yes.
Illegal aliens.
Yes.
That sounds like somebody from Mars, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And as opposed to someone whose documents aren't in order. That makes a person. And disability advocates have done this. You know, stop talking about the disabled.
Right.
Start talking about
what they can do.
Challenge. Right. Challenge or differently abled, or, you know, change the way you think about it so that you can think about the individual rather than.
Well, I mean, isn't what you were saying, we don't want to become a minority? Mm-hmm. But actually, why not? Mm-hmm. Why are we so arrogant to think that we always are going to be the big group? Mm-hmm. They're all those people that are minorities, they're people that are deserving of our compassion. Yeah. And.
But I think if I remember the conversation with Gigi, she was afraid that, like, Muslims in that religion, which is becoming the overwhelming worldwide, you know, biggest, and they're especially from an Orthodox viewpoint, they're it's very man oriented, and the men impose certain restrictions on the women, and she would not want to be in that situation where, you know, as a woman, you have to behave certain ways, wear certain clothing, and stuff like that.
But again, that's not part of the religion, exactly. That's the country's interpretation of it, because it isn't that way everywhere.
I know, but right.
But that's the fear.
But that's fear, yeah. That, you know, without personal contact with that group, without enough knowledge, that's what happens.
Well, and also, and we are sometimes unwilling to admit this to ourselves, we look at how we treat minorities in our country, and we don't want to be treated that way. Which brings us back to the commandment of God to treat others the way we want to be treated.
Right.
So, you know, the phrase white privilege or male privilege has become very a hot button phrase, but that's what it means, is that, you know, I can speed down the street with my tail light out and not really have to worry about it, because the worst thing that's going to happen to me is I'm going to get a ticket. That's because I'm a white middle-class woman, right? That's what that means. You know, if I were an African-American man speeding down the street with a taillight out, I could end up dead.
Especially in the wrong neighborhood.
Right. And the wrong neighborhood might be this one, you know, because the police here might not think I belonged.
Exactly.
So... it's, you know, that's what that concept means, is that as a white person in the United States in 2019, I can choose to talk about race and think about race, or I can choose not to. That's privilege. An African American, an Asian person, doesn't have the choice to consider whether they're going to worry about race today.
They're probably always worrying about it.
They're always worrying about it, yeah. Because they have to.
That movie, Green Book, did you see that?
No, exactly.
It won the Academy Award.
That was very controversial.
Right, but I mean, it's interesting. A lot of people are not aware of that history that the actual Green Book showed us. And so I think that's one reason it's a real wake up.
Well, I think even when you mentioned, I think as a woman, I mean, there are degrees.
Yes, the privilege, sure,
I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
That, as a woman, we just got the vote 100 years ago. We've had to. Sure. In fact, I have to say, in the last election, it amazed me the young people who didn't realize what women had fought for, or they were so used to it that they didn't appreciate what women, even in my generation, what we did for them, so that they could do what they're doing.
And there are probably still a lot of companies where... you know, there's inequality between the sexes in terms of promotions and salary.
Well,
and
the salaries are not equivalent. Have not come up.
Well, even the way we dress. I was in college when Canisius, when they got rid of the dress code. Immediately, the men went to jeans and t-shirts, and we women were in skirts, and we debated whether anybody felt safe enough to wear slacks.
That's right.
Yeah. And one girl came in with wool slacks on, still the same top. Yes. She had wool pants. You know, she didn't come in jeans.
Right.
We had to be more careful that we were ladylike, that we were, and I don't think... Yeah. We've gotten farther, but
it's still true today. One of the things that I was just reading a study about it, that if when you're hired, if a man advocates for himself for more pay, it's seen as ambitious and that's a good thing. If a woman advocates for herself to get more pay, it's seen as pushy.
Aggressive.
Aggressive, which are negatives.
Watch the candidates as this goes on.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's...
being bitchy, I hate to use that word.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
It's happening with Amy Klobuchar. You know, she's getting all this pushback about being directive with her staff, right? That she wants things a particular way and tells her staff exactly what she wants. That's being seen as a real negative. In a man, it would be seen as being clear, right? So there's still that, you know, when we talk about those things, it's, you know, it's still
on. I was watching a program, one of those bridge programs the other night, and it took place in New Zealand, and it was about a family that moved from Australia over to New Zealand, and the kids, and they were being not welcome. There was a bully group, that sort of thing, and the head of the group hurled in a comment toward the newcomer and accused him of doing something, whatever it was, that appeared to be, oh, how gay, you know. And the newcomer said, oh, I can't believe it. There are still people out there who consider gay an insult. And I thought, oh, isn't that a nice line?
It's, you know, so the way we talk about people, the way we speak about people, those kinds of things. So solidarity, the idea that we're all one, is one of the things that we use as we're building an ethic. So how do we, an ethic of justice. So if we talk about immigration, the idea that all human beings are the same and should be treated the same is something you could put into your ethic of justice. The other thing is that everyone who's a citizen is the same, is something, should be treated the same, is something you can put in your ethic of justice. Another way to think about solidarity is everyone who belongs to a particular group should be treated the same. So refugees from everywhere should be treated the same, not just refugees who look like us or who... That's another way to apply solidarity to our ethics of justice.
I mean, the church tries to say we're all children of God.
Right.
To look at each other that way, but I don't know how far that goes.
It's hard. It's a challenge. And again, it comes back to, you know, when we say we all have sinned, this is what we mean, is that we all are children of God. God calls us all to treat one another that way. And Jesus was pretty clear that that applies, that when he says love your neighbor, he doesn't just mean those who live on either side of you. He does actually mean everybody. But that's really hard. And we do it imperfectly. And the reasons we do it imperfectly are sin. We don't like to think about it that way because it makes us uncomfortable. I don't like to think about myself as a sinner. But that's really the point. Mm-hmm. And why everyone has a sin they need to repent of. And everyone has a sin that they're not going to repent of today because I'm just not sorry. Or I may be sorry if I think about it, but I'm not going to think about it.
Do it again.
Or, you know, I'm just really not willing to give that up. So, you know, this is all of us. And it's why, when will the world see that they need Jesus?
not to talk about me, but yeah, sure. What brought this to my mind back, when I was younger, I did a mm-hmm. children's mass with mm-hmm. Father Larry. He was a young 30-year-old mm-hmm. priest in our parish. Very sweet man, but in heart condition. He was mm-hmm. very, very sick. Kept going into the hospital. And one day I was at the rectory, I planned the mass, and I came back out, and mm-hmm. I was in the kitchen, and this gentleman was sitting, he had a work outfit on, mm-hmm. heavy set, mm-hmm. and I was very formal with him. Mm-hmm. You know, he was asking me questions. He had a little twinkle in his eye, but he was very formal with me. I left, and I realized I wasn't, you know, I was trying not to be, I didn't know him yet. I left, I realized it was Father Larry. His mm-hmm. medicine had swelled him up mm-hmm. to the point, and then all of a sudden I felt, those eyes, what is with those eyes? Mm-hmm. And it made me realize mm-hmm. there was a different person in there than mm-hmm. who I thought it was. You know, mm-hmm. that he was in there, even though he didn't look like himself, mm-hmm. and he wore this outfit instead of his priestly garb. I think that was like a revelation for me, mm-hmm. to try to look mm-hmm. beyond what you're seeing on the outside. Mm-hmm. But it's hard
mm-hmm.
to do.
It's hard to do.
It's really hard.
It is hard to do. And that's why Christianity is difficult, but it's also why justice is difficult. Because the root of justice is putting ourselves in the place of the other and treating them as we would wish to be treated in that place. But that's really hard to do.
But that seems like the one thing that could guide everything. Mm-hmm. If we could just do that. Mm-hmm. We could mm-hmm. answer all our questions.
But see, that's what I wonder, too. Mm-hmm. How do we discuss topics that are so difficult? Immigration, mm-hmm. abortion. Is it help us to see where that other person's coming from? In some mm-hmm. way, some of the things we've talked about here. But with immigration, I'm trying to think, okay, you know, with abortion, you can see the care for right. the, you know, people who can't care for themselves. But with immigration, what is it? You know, what is the mm-hmm. benevolent or the moral thing where these people are coming from? And I don't, you know... How do you have that discussion?
Mm-hmm. Well, you meet people that... We talk a lot in the church about meeting people where they are. Mm-hmm. You meet people where they are. So why... What is it that you're afraid of? What is it that, you know... Meet someone who has the different size. Explain to me why you feel that way. Mm-hmm. And get them to talk about why they feel that way. Because the only way to truly understand someone is to have a conversation and see where they're coming from, right? You may still end up disagreeing with them. And but at least then you'll be able to see them as a person. And the other piece is to remember that there are a lot of things that people would say you are wrong or unjust or sinful, whatever word you want to use. About there are places where even if you think the person you're talking to is responding out of fear on the issue of immigration, there are things you do out of fear. And so to bring that, to bring acknowledgement of your own shortcomings into a conversation. So that's a piece of it too. And that's really the purpose of working through these things, to really think through. It's really easy to say, well, I stand for social justice. Okay, that's great. What does that mean, and why? Mm-hmm. And where are the places that you're still struggling with what truly standing for justice would mean in your life?
Especially since there's so many different aspects to,
right.
to the...
I find myself, I don't want to talk to people.
Who just, well, and...
I mean, about people are so adamant that, you know, my take on them is... They're not thinking rationally, but is my view of rational thinking like I think only, or what, you know? So I avoid, I don't want to talk
because
to people,
it's people
like
that.
That
we other, in other respects, feel close to. You know, I have people that I respect who feel very differently on some of these topics, and it's hard to.
Yeah, it is.
So I'm trying to come around and say, okay, where are they coming from? Where are they? But... That's a tough thing to resolve sometimes.
It is.
Yes.
A lot of it comes to how is that going to affect my life personally? If I need to have any of it too.
Well, I remember one person in particular, her sister's from California, and she said, you know, I understand where my sister's coming from. She doesn't want those people. She sees people coming out of vans, and it frightens her, and she doesn't want them around. I said, well, why? Because... they're taking jobs or, you know, something. She goes, no, she just doesn't, it frightens her, she just doesn't want them around. They're coming in cars. I said, well, how do you know they weren't coming from work and they're all just having to be in one car? She was adamant, and in every other respect, we're very similar, but she had talked to her sister, and maybe things in California are different. I don't know, maybe.
They're similar in Kansas.
Yeah. It's hard to...
It's, you know, and again... You know, when I lived in Cincinnati, I lived in a very multicultural place. You know, my downstairs neighbors were professors at the University of Cincinnati. They had come from India. My upstairs neighbors had come from Burma. And so that was the place that I lived. When I first moved here, it made me very uncomfortable. I couldn't quite figure out why I was a little bit uncomfortable in Clarence. It's because... I could go for days
and not see
a person of color. And it took me a little while. But if you're used to living in a place where everybody looks like you, then it becomes very uncomfortable. And also, people are different. So, you know, my upstairs neighbors play bongo drums. They're loud. And my downstairs neighbors cook Indian food, which I love, but, you know, it smells. And so, you know, if you're not used to that, then, you know, well, you know, and it's easy to say, you know, those people are making noise or, you know, they're being too loud or, you know. So
my mother didn't want to cook with garlic. She
right.
thought we were too Italian.
It smelled her house, smelled like garlic.
Exactly.
You know, how long ago was it, not very, when Italians were the other?
Yes.
The Irish were the other. And
Polish were the other.
And now, that's the one.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it does happen. You know, it does happen.
It's because the generations, I mean, kids, people come not speaking English, but their kids want to speak English, and they meet other people in school, and they marry, and they intermarry.
And it happens the same way with every wave of immigrants that have happened. You know, we could pick up our conversation we're having today and put it down in the 1870s, and it would fit. It's just that we have TV now. And so we can yell it, and so we're more connected in a strange way, we're both more and less connected. We see what's going on immediately, and we can interact with people we don't know, which is new. but in a lot of ways, we interact less with our neighbors, yeah, our actual neighbors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, I mean, if you look at the U.S. compared to many, many countries, mm-hmm. we do have more people that look different.
Mm-hmm. We do.
We have people that look every way here. Mm-hmm. I mean, some countries, you know, Asian countries have mm-hmm. only people who look one way.
I know,
way.
One way. Mm-hmm.
One way.
Yes.
So, I mean.
And I find that intriguing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And we've said that, you know, that is our strength, mm-hmm. right? But it comes with challenges. The flip side of your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. And that's true of individuals and of nations and of groups, right? So all of that is...
So we're much more accepting of the right. people who look different mm-hmm. if they have enough money or mm-hmm. enough education.
Yes.
Right, but how do we look at white, poor mm-hmm. white people, too? Mm-hmm. I mean, I always...
Down.
Mm-hmm. I know. Mm-hmm. I'm really conscious of myself thinking, oh, well, they probably didn't go to college, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. with white people. And it's like, ooh, mm-hmm. I'm thinking that? Mm-hmm. It's really bad. Yeah. mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm going to call this conversation to an end because I think we've done this. What I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is when we pick up on the 20th, to move into... looking at world religions and look at Buddhism and Islam and Shintoism and some of the different beliefs. And we'll start with basics and then we'll see if we want to go any deeper.
That's great.
Okay?
Sure. That's great.
Does that sound
great.
Fine?
Wonderful.
And we'll go with that for as long as it takes and see where we are.
Okay.
Okay? Since we're taking a 2-week break, it's a perfect time for me to do my homework. So.
Say again. Hello. Our next meeting is on the 20th.
The next meeting is on the 20th.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I hope Art will come back.
Yes, I will.
What order would you do the religion?
I don't know yet. It depends on a little bit.
Hello.